So after a full day of both silent and relational meditation practice, tonight I'd like to bring in a little bit more context for what we're doing here. So as you may or may not remember, the title of this retreat is Together and Alone, Finding Freedom Individually and Collectively. And when Nick and I were first discussing what freedom means to us, as well as the kind of themes that we like to bring in to support that freedom, we discovered that we are both interested in views, specifically how views form and inform every aspect of our lives, including of ourselves and of the world, which of course then directly affects where and how and why we practice. And it directly affects the benefits that we can get from all those efforts. Now, not surprisingly, because he was pretty enlightened, the Buddha was very aware of the power of views to either get in the way of our progress towards freedom or to support it. So in the context of his teachings, there's a range of views about views, depending on whether the views are skillful or unskillful, beneficial or unbeneficial. So this evening I'd like to start where the Buddha started, with the importance of establishing right or wise view, which, as I think most of you know, is the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path being, in effect, the Buddha's prescription for how to heal ourselves, how to release all unsatisfactoriness, stress, distress, suffering, or dukkha, to use the Pali term. Before we go any further into what the Buddha meant specifically by right or wise view in the context of the Noble Eightfold Path, I wanted to take a little bit of time just to explore what this term view means more generally. On one level, it's quite straightforward. The Buddha used the word view in the same way that we use it in ordinary everyday English, as an aspect of vision, of physically seeing with the eyes of looking. But again, in English as in Pali, the term view also refers to the mental experience of forming a view or an opinion, as in a perspective or a position or a standpoint. And now it gets a bit more tricky, because we've moved out of simply seeing into the mental realm of concepts. And just to get a sense of that, and I'll read you a few common definitions and synonyms of what the word view can mean. So angle, or assessment, or assumption, or attitude, or belief, or conception, conclusion, conviction, hypothesis, idea, impression, judgment, mindset. I'm only halfway through. I'm not going to finish them all because it could take the rest of the talk. But just to illustrate, there are a lot of different words to convey views. And I thought maybe, you know, in some cultures they have apparently lots of different words to talk about, say, snow. Whatever's of interest to that culture, they build a lot of words around. And in dominant mainstream culture, views and opinions and mental concepts seem to be pretty fascinating. So there are pages of ways that we can develop views. And even though there are a lot of words to describe these views, at the same time in our lived experience, they're often invisible to us. And even though we might not see them, they're powerfully affecting where and how we look and who and what we see. And in turn, that further strengthens the underlying views. And if we're not able to bring awareness to this whole process, our worldview can get smaller and smaller. And it can really impede our capacity to see clearly and to free ourselves from all of that distorted thinking. Now, in case that's sounding a bit abstract so far, just to get a quick sense of those two aspects of the term view, the physical and the mental or conceptual aspects. If your eyes are closed, you might just take a moment to open them and just look at me for a moment. Just take a quick look, that's all. So as you look at me, you're seeing me. You're viewing me, so to speak. But, and that viewing, it's not so innocent. How you're seeing me is informed by all kinds of conditioning. Conditioning that comes from your temperament, your personality, your individual history, your social location, the previous interactions that you've had with me, and so on. So whether you're aware of it or not, whether you like it or not, some degree of projection and distortion is happening as you see me, in quotation marks. So as well as all the visual input that's coming into your eyes, all of you will also have some mental views of me, of who I am, independent of what you're actually seeing. And that's okay. I'll try not to take it personally. And to be clear, we're not trying to completely stop this process of perception. Some degree of perceiving, it's inevitable. What we are trying to do is to recognize more clearly when our minds are under the sway of a view and to discern whether that view is helpful or not. There's a famous quote in relation to all this. It's been attributed to Anais Nin and to Stephen Covey and to the Talmud. It says, "We don't see things as they are, we see things as we are." We don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. And the Buddha also could have said it, because it aligns with his recognition about just how subjective our views of ourselves and the world are. Even as we usually assume that our view, my view, is completely objective, accurate, and real. And this has huge implications for how we live our lives, including how we engage with the Dhamma, the Buddha's teachings. So, given the enormous power of views to shape our whole lives, it makes sense that the Buddha would put right view right at the start of the Noble Eightfold Path. Because if we think of this path as a journey, we need to make sure that we're oriented in the right direction if we're going to have any hope of getting where we want to be. So what is right view? Traditionally, it's about understanding, practicing, directly experiencing the whole of the Buddha's teachings. Now, we've got 9 days, so that might be a little bit too big of an endeavor. So I'm going to try and keep it a bit more manageable and just focus really on one key principle that underlies pretty much all of the Buddha's teachings. And that's the principle of causality or conditionality. The understanding that nothing arises in a vacuum. Everything is influenced by everything else. All experiences arise and exist due to certain causes or conditions. And all experiences will cease once these causes and conditions are removed. And this principle is expressed very simply, even formulaically, all through the Buddhist discourses. Some of you may have heard this. It says, "When this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that." Got it? It sounds a bit like a early koan. Now, in my own practice, I was baffled for a really long time by what this was pointing to. It was just too pithy, too abstract for my unsubtle mind to get. I couldn't grasp the significance of it. And it's taken quite a while to recognize that it's about understanding conditions. In other words, what kind of conditions tend to create more unsatisfactoriness, stress, distress, suffering, dukkha? And what kind of conditions help that same dukkha to release? And this principle of conditionality underlies the Four Noble Truths. First, we have to understand that there is dukkha. Dukkha is a fact of life. That's the common translation of the First Noble Truth. There just is dukkha. That's a basic condition, and to the extent that we accept that truth, instead of resisting, ignoring, avoiding, denying, fighting dukkha, to that same extent we'll have more capacity to become curious and to see more clearly what's causing this dukkha. And the Buddha pointed us in the right direction by naming that there is a cause of dukkha. And the cause of dukkha is craving, also translated as thirsting or hungering. And this is the second noble truth. Seeing how our own reactivity of wanting and not wanting, clinging and resisting, craving and rejecting, only adds to that original dukkha. So some of you may have had some trace of that experience even today. Maybe at times getting caught up in fighting dukkha in ways that made it worse. And this is where we need the third noble truth, which acknowledges that that craving can cease with the right conditions. It is possible to bring an end to all of that unskillful reactivity. But unfortunately, at least I can't, I think we can't just tell ourselves, stop it. Stop clinging. Stop resisting. Stop craving. We don't seem to be able to just put a stop to it. We actually need a whole array of different methods and approaches, ones that work on different aspects of our lives simultaneously. And the Buddha gave us just that in the Fourth Noble Truth. So the Fourth Noble Truth is a holistic prescription, and it invites us to develop our ethical understanding, or sila, together with cultivating meditative insights. And these combine to ripen into a more embodied and intuitive wisdom. And that wisdom then feeds back into even more refined ethical understanding, more powerful meditative insights, and even more profound wisdom. So it sets up a whole chain reaction of positive causes and conditions that lead onward and upward to deeper and deeper freedom. And that's exactly what we're doing here on this retreat. So to get a slightly different sense of that connection between right view and the Four Noble Truths, I'd like to share a passage from Gil Fronsdal. And it highlights the importance of paying attention to how are we relating to whatever is happening. He says, for the Buddha's path, this orienting perspective called right view, it's the practice of keeping an eye on our relationship to whatever we're experiencing. Classically, this is described as using the perspective of the Four Noble Truths. Rather than getting caught up in our opinions and abstract interpretations of what we're experiencing, in this approach, we ask ourselves a series of questions. Do we feel any stress, discomfort, or suffering in how we're relating to what's happening or not happening? What's our contribution to this suffering? What are we clinging to that is contributing to the suffering? Right view includes the encouraging perspective that clinging and its resulting suffering can be brought to an end. It also orients us to the practices of the entire Eightfold Path as the easiest and clearest path to liberation from suffering. So really paying attention to how we're relating to our experience is crucial. And those of you who've done previous retreats with me, you've probably heard me recommend this practice of bringing in three questions whenever we recognize that we're getting lost or confused or reactive in some way. And these three questions are designed to show us what's the relationship to what's happening. So the first question is just to ask what's happening in the body, like we were doing earlier today in the relational practice, just to tune in what physical sensations are happening. How's the overall bodily energy? And you might do that right now, just like a snapshot, instantaneous. What's happening in the body? Not overthinking it, but just getting a felt sense. How's the body now? And then in the same way, you can ask that question in relation to the heart and the mind. So by heart and mind, I mean what thoughts, emotions, moods, mind states are present. And again, you might just do that now. What's happening in the heart mind? Just to notice. And then lastly, having got clearer about your experience, the third question is, what's the attitude in the mind about it? Or in other words, how am I relating to this experience? And this last question can be so helpful for revealing the beginning stages of unskillful mental reactivity. We can start to recognize with that last question, what's the attitude in the mind? Oh, not liking. Irritation, frustration, resistance, judgment, self-judgment, boredom, loneliness, lust, doubt, jealousy, resentment, etc., etc., etc. Another great list that I could take too much time going into. But just wondering, does anybody have no idea what I'm talking about here? I'm guessing you may have tasted, touched at least one of those unskillful qualities sometime today. And this is helpful because this is where our exploration of right view and conditions, specifically what conditions support clear seeing, what conditions get in the way, this is where that exploration gets really real. Now, because we're in the early days of this retreat still, actually it's only the first full day, quite amazing. Feels like day three. We are very much still in the early days of the retreat, just the first full day. So to some extent, we're still just arriving. And probably our mindfulness isn't particularly refined yet. We haven't had enough time to settle in and to develop more steadiness and stability of mind. That will come later, I assure you, as we learn how to support the right causes and conditions. But for now, I want to just take a little bit of time to explore some of those very common unskillful mental states. Excuse me. I'm having a hindrance attack because I'm about to talk about the hindrances. So, these common unskillful mental states that tend to come up pretty easily in the early days of a retreat. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha instructed us to train in recognizing these five particular unskillful states that are known as the five hindrances. And the reason he singled them out is because in the context of our insight practice of clear seeing, they tend to get in the way of that clear seeing. And in the context of daily life, they tend to cause us harm, which makes us more likely to harm others too. So there's an ethical dimension to right view. We want to try to prevent our minds from being affected by these hindrances, not only for our own well-being and ease and peace, but so we don't cause problems for other people too. Now, some of you here might be newer to practice. You might not necessarily recognize these hindrances by name, but I'm guessing when you hear what they are, you'll probably recognize at least one or two of them. And those of you who've done retreats with me before, you can probably guess that it's a pop quiz time. So I like to invite people to see if they can recognize, remember what these five hindrances are, because it is a list that's really worth knowing. So it's also helpful to do them in order. So anyone remember what the first hindrance is? I'm not looking at you, Kim, because you always know. But please, go ahead. Yes, sensual pleasure, desire for sense pleasure. Any kind of wanting, craving for sense pleasures, for comfort, for clinging to pleasant sights and sounds and smells and tastes and physical sensations, mental experiences. What about the second one? Anyone beside Kim? Thank you, aversion or ill will. The opposite of desire, any kind of not wanting, pushing away, rejecting, includes the energies of anger and fear and all the subtle shades of those. Okay, someone new. Third hindrance at the back there. Sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, thank you. These are old-fashioned words for lethargy of the body and dullness of the mind. So they're different forms of mental and physical low energy. And then the fourth one, someone else? Restlessness. Yes, thank you. Restlessness and worry. So that's the opposite imbalance of too much energy, the body and mind being agitated, not being able to stay still, or looping over and over in mental patterns of anxiety. Then the last one, doubt. Someone's very clear about doubt. Often translated as skeptical doubt. So any kind of useless questioning that leaves us paralyzed and undermines our capacity to do anything. So that's just a really brief overview of what these five hindrances are. And maybe you recognize one or two of them and you have a sense of how they get in the way of insight. I'm not going to go into them in too much more detail tonight. I just want to keep things more on the overview level. So just to say, I think it's pretty clear that when the hindrances are present, it's very difficult for insights to arise. But because of this, that conditionality, when the hindrances are absent, their absence supports actually our capacity to experience more ease, relief, peace, freedom. So by understanding conditionality, we can start to learn how do we help those hindrances to move along. And the first step in the whole process involves learning to recognize when they're present. Because if we don't even know that they're there, we have no chance of helping them to release. So for every one of us, the practice involves learning to recognize how do each of these hindrances show up for us individually. Because they each will have their own unique signature patterns. Different ways that they tend to show up for us in terms of the body, the heart, the mind. And as we get more familiar with them, we learn how to identify them more and more quickly before they get too much of a hold on us. So mindfulness, as always, is the crucial first step. But we also need to be aware, again, how are we relating to the experience of them? And this can be challenging because by their very nature, the hindrances are unpleasant. So we often have a pretty unhelpful reactivity towards them. And to be fair, even the word, the term hindrances, has pretty negative connotations. And it can trigger the belief that the hindrances are wrong, they're bad, they shouldn't be happening, and we need to get rid of them as quickly as possible. Which you may have recognized is itself a hindrance. It's the hindrance of aversion. And this is very common. I've noticed how, at least in my own practice, how these hindrances generally, they don't show up nicely one at a time in a neatly numbered, ordered list, the way they're presented in the teachings. They tend to hunt in packs. And once one gets a foot in the door, all the rest jump in, pile on for the party. So it's pretty common that we take these hindrances personally and tend to see them as our own unique shortcomings rather than as something that every meditator who ever lived has had to learn how to work with, including the Buddha. So because it is so common to identify with the hindrances and to take them personally and to add more aversion to the whole thing, I think I've shared with some of you, I appreciate how the English Dharma teacher Rob Berbea, he used to talk to about the hindrances. He called them manifestations of our humanity. And you might just get a sense of, does that give a different flavor, a different relationship to them? Certainly on retreat, sometimes people come into the individual meetings with me and they say, wow, I've been manifesting so much humanity today. And it's good to be able to laugh because taking the hindrances personally only makes them stronger. So what we're trying to do is similar to what we were doing this afternoon, where we were exploring our physical sensations. With that attitude of openness, of interest, of curiosity, objective awareness. In the same way, we're training to recognize the hindrances, to see that they too are impersonal phenomena. They're arising due to conditions, and they will pass due to conditions. They're not me. They're not mine. They're not who I am. And they're not my fault. They're just neurons firing in the brain. And they only have as much power as we give to them. So I hope you're starting to get a sense that understanding conditionality as a crucial aspect of right view is profoundly empowering. And right view is the first stage of the Noble Eightfold Path, because it gives us a sense of where we're going and how to get there. So we're on this journey. And if we think of the term path more broadly as a journey, I sometimes think of this journey as being on board a waka. And for those of you not from Aotearoa, a waka is a canoe. And canoes were the main means of travel for Maori people for many centuries. That's how they were able to get from Polynesia all the way to here, to Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I still find that just an incredible feat of navigation, open ocean navigation. And it involved just the most incredible attunement to the stars, to the currents, to the tides, to the winds, the ocean life, the fish, the birds all around them. And we can think of the journey that each one of us is on, maybe, is like being on a waka. And in the suttas, the discourses, there are many references to entering the stream of the Dharma. And it's said that the stream naturally flows into the great ocean, which in this context is a metaphor for freedom. And so with the waka metaphor, as we're moving downstream, yes, inevitably there'll be times when we get caught up in eddies, whirlpools, backwaters that slow our progress. But we can, if we find ourselves metaphorically going backwards, feeling stagnant or stuck, right view is the crucial first stage, step. We keep investigating. We keep asking, Is what I'm doing now in this meditation or in my everyday life, is it skillful or unskillful? Is it leading to ease and freedom or not? And if it isn't, we understand how we can steer ourselves back into the current so we can start making that downstream progress again. So Gil Fronsdal has a way of framing this understanding of right view by asking whether what we're doing is feeding karma or feeding dharma. So karma is another word for intentional activity. And again, because of conditionality, what we repeatedly think and say and do has an effect on our hearts and minds. And in turn, that affects how we experience the world. So when Gil uses the word karma in this context, it's a way of asking, are we strengthening familiar habits and unconscious patterns of reactivity or not? And if not, then we're feeding dharma, as he calls it. And by this he means strengthening those skillful qualities of heart and mind that do support our capacity to live with more ease and freedom. So we can also bring this understanding of conditionality into the realm of modern neuroscience. Modern neuroscience now recognizes, just as the Buddha did all those hundreds of years ago, that our brains are not static organs. Because of neuroplasticity, what we think about, how we think, the emotions we feel, all of these are constantly shaping, forming, sculpting our hearts and minds. So in perhaps a more poetic way, the English monk Ajahn Suchito talks about this process as a process of crafting the heart, crafting or shaping the heart. And he uses the analogy of a craftsperson getting to know their material. So whether the craftsperson is working with wood or clay or metal or glass or paper, in the same way, we start by getting to know our own hearts and minds. We sensitize ourselves, become intimate with what's actually going on in there. We meet our experience with patience and kindness and interest. And through that process, we learn how to gently work with and shape the heart in ways that allow its natural strength and beauty to come out. So there's a key attitude in all of this talk of steering and shaping and sculpting. I briefly referred to it already, but just to emphasize again now the importance of not taking any of this personally. This is in fact a key insight that the right view of conditionality opens us up to. Everything arises due to impersonal causes and conditions. So it doesn't make sense to take any of it personally, appropriate it, identify with any of it. And when we really get this, it can be so relieving, so freeing. But until we have really got it, it's very common to keep getting caught in judging our experience, to keep getting caught in binaries of right and wrong and good and bad and success and failure. And so if we're stuck in that paradigm, when we hear about qualities such as the hindrances or the need to distinguish between skillful and unskillful, it can be very easy to have that fuel judgment and self-judgment. So what these teachings are inviting instead is discernment rather than judgment. And there's a crucial difference. So discernment simply recognizes, as Nick was quoting Ajahn Sumedho, it's like this. That's all, it's like this. Oh, aversion is present. Boredom has arisen. Okay, this is how restlessness feels. Those are thoughts about doubt. Judgment, on the other hand, takes it all personally and makes it all about me. Oh, I'm so aversive. I shouldn't be so judgmental. I'm always grumpy on retreat. I should be kinder. I'm not doing this right again. I can't believe I'm going through another multiple hindrance attack. And we can see with that judgment, there starts to be a lot of I-ing and my-ing in the mind. And right there is an indication that we've moved away from right view and into identification, which, as the Buddha recognized, is a key way that we enhance our suffering, our dukkha. So over the course of this retreat, Nick and I will be coming back to different aspects of views, of right view, and how identification and attachment to self-view gets in the way of right view. And we'll be exploring how releasing self-view on deeper and deeper levels is the key to living with more ease and freedom. I am aware I've used the word ease quite a lot this evening, so I just want to be clear about what the ease this is pointing to is. It's not the ease of just being more comfortable. If that was the way to freedom, we could all just rest all day in that cozy nook in the carpeted room next door. We could just curl up with a pile of hot water bottles and a good book, and we could watch the punga trees dancing in the wind, and we could listen to the rain outside and enjoy the warmth of the fire. And actually, that sounds pretty nice. And yes, it is could be nice, temporarily pleasant. But doing that over and over again isn't going to get us anywhere. The ease and freedom that the Buddha's pointing to is an ease that's available independent of outer circumstances. It may sound paradoxical, but true freedom allows us to experience ease even when situations are uncomfortable, unpleasant, painful. And I know all of you here, you understand that to some extent already, or you wouldn't be here. So for every one of us, this process, this journey towards freedom, it's already underway. So I'd like to finish with a quote from the suttas that illustrates that when we get the right conditions in place, this is just a natural process. And this analogy appears over and over in the discourses, how when we set up the right conditions, skillful states emerge and form a positive chain reaction, an organic momentum that just flows effortlessly in the direction of freedom. So it says, practitioners, suppose it rains heavily on a mountaintop and the water flows downhill to fill the hollows, crevices, and creeks. As they become full, they fill up the pools. The pools fill up the lakes. The lakes fill up the streams. And the streams fill up the rivers. And as the rivers become full, they fill up the ocean. In the same way, a practitioner has experiential confidence in the Buddha, the teaching, and the Sangha, and the ethics loved by the wise ones. These things flow onwards. And after crossing to the far shore, they lead to the ending of defilements. So the far shore is another name for awakening, for liberation. So I offer that image just as a reminder that all of this, it's a natural process, and it's happening due to conditioning, due to conditions, and it's already happening for every one of us. So with right view in place, may all of our efforts here on this retreat help us to flow towards experiencing ever-deepening freedom of heart and mind. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.